Good evening, everyone. And good evening, people on Zoom who couldn't be with us in person. I'm delighted to be back with you again. And Adora Lee, I want to mention that perhaps the reason you didn't remember that I had been here in person before was because you were not able to be here that evening because you were supporting your husband in a something related to the troubles we're having around immigration. So you were not here that night. So I thought I would just start by well, let me start very briefly by saying something that I feel complete confidence in, complete confidence. And that is that reality has no obligation to agree with my views about it. I have complete confidence in this. And I'm not sure I have much confidence in anything else, but with this I have complete confidence. I thought I would talk first about Suzuki Roshi's talk in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, about the large pasture, giving your horse or your sheep or your cow a large pasture. And at one point in there, he talks about let's say you're in extraordinary circumstances. If you try to calm your mind, you will be unable to sit. And if you try not to be disturbed, your effort will not be right effort. And he says, the only effort that will help you is to count your breathing or to concentrate on your inhaling and exhaling. We say concentration, but to concentrate your mind on something is not the true purpose of Zen. The true purpose is to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. This is to put everything under control in the widest sense. And I believe this is the teaching that we need right now. Right now. With the situations that are coming up in our country, I don't know if everyone here feels a sense of grief, because not everyone has the same viewpoint on the situation that's arising. Some people think this is the greatest. And I feel it's really important that we allow for all viewpoints, even when we really feel differently ourselves. On Saturday morning, I went to a protest I hadn't been to before. This was in Los Gatos. It was a small group in front of the library, and the people who organized this, they belonged to a coalition, I think, that was against racism. And they had two large boards with the names of all the people who had died in the custody of ICE in 22, or ICE and Border Patrol, Customs, whatever, in 2025 and then in 2026. And it was billed as a silent vigil, a one-hour silent vigil. But actually, there was quite a bit of talking at first, and then a person came, a young woman, a very pleasant-looking young woman, and she started telling us we were wrong, and she started putting forth her viewpoint, and immediately everybody started pushing back, you know? And I thought, wow. Maybe we should just listen to her. And so I just said something. Everybody has different viewpoints. Maybe we could listen. And then we did sort of listen. There was still some talking. And after a little while, she left. And then we were silent for maybe 20 minutes, as silent as we could be. Some people had a very hard time being silent. But nonetheless, we had a kind of silent vigil. And then toward the end, someone mentioned that someone else had been killed, and that was, of course, Alex Jeffrey Preddy. And so I went home, and I was reading a little bit about it, and there's the area where I live, there's many protest opportunities. So there's numerous Tesla takedowns, and so I kind of have a difficulty with them sometimes because it's a difficult area, protesting, because what one considers okay varies from person to person in terms of how one objects or what one says about another person. So that mockery and making fun of can spill over into a kind of degradation or denigration of a person that I don't feel comfortable with, no matter who they are. I think the Buddha in the early suttas, it's my memory that even when he's saying these people are wrong, he says, these noble ones, and then he's talking about how they're wrong. So it's a difficult issue. But anyway, I go back and forth because when these things happen, I feel like I want to be with the people who are out there protesting. It's my own personal view. So I was about to go out to go to one of these protests in the afternoon. And then, but somebody was telling me, something's not right here. Something's not right here. Why don't you go to the Y? And I went to the Y. And for me in that moment, that was the right thing to do, to go to the Y and do some exercise. So my feet were on the ground. My feet were on the ground. Earlier in the evening, Karen and I were talking. I hope you don't mind my mentioning this. Karen said that the question comes up for you, what can I do? What can I do to help this situation? This is a question that comes up for me, and I think perhaps for many of you that question may come up. What can I do? What's helpful here? So I'll just share with you some of the things I reflect on. First of all, that it is that edge between equanimity and indifference. One has to work with that edge. Is it equanimity or is it indifference? And I also notice, because I do know someone in my extended family who I'm quite fond of, who's a lovely, lovely person and is an adamant MAGA, full-on MAGA supporter. So I've experienced firsthand the difficulties that one has when there's a difference of opinion about things. And a person sincerely believes something very different from what I believe. So perhaps you think I have some kind of answer, but I don't. I have more of a question. So just to put a few more words around it, and then maybe open it up for some discussion. I just want to bring this out so I know what time it is. What time do we end? 9 o'clock? Okay, so it's 8:16 now. Maybe I'll talk for another till 8:30 or so, and then leave some time for questions. Maybe just for a little levity, in a recent meeting that Jim and I were in online with Reb Anderson, many of you know, he told the story about his grandson, about his grandson asking him, "What's your favorite animal?" And he said, "Human." And his grandson said, "Human's not an animal." And I don't think Reb corrected him. It's just like a couple of days later, his grandson asked him again, "What's your favorite animal?" And he said, "Human." And again, humans are not animals. And then a few days later, same question, same answer. His grandson said, So I share that with my teacher, that I also feel humans are my favorite animal. I'm very fond of a particular child psychiatrist, long dead. Her name is Selma Freiberg. She wrote a book about children from 0 to 5 years called The Magic Years. And she said she called it The Magic Years, not out of any sense of nostalgia for childhood, but more that children at those ages think of themselves as magicians. I'm hungry, I cry, I'm fed, I'm wonderful. They control the universe in their minds. So she wrote, her husband, after she died, collected some of her papers and published it. It's in the Marin County Library. You could probably borrow it if you wanted to, through inner office for Link Plus, the library system. But one of the essays in her wonderful collection of essays, but one is called On the Origin of Human Bonds, or Human Bonding. And so we have the concept of Sangha, but when you ask in a deep sense, why do we come together in a group? Well, because we're animals. We're the type of animal that comes together in groups. This is animal behavior. We want to be with each other. Why do we have rituals? She shows the origin of human bonding as being rituals. And this is not just, it's not just human beings. Fish have rituals, and wolves have rituals. So it's just an interesting point. It's a digression, a little bit of a digression. But the thing to know about rituals and about, and this goes to our, to the larger point of when we don't agree with somebody. Rituals often involve scapegoating, you know, and we don't necessarily see that in our own rituals, and it's not so obvious. But for example, I think the first example she gives is a type of fish where the female during the mating season takes on these very beautiful rich red colors that are actually, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull, and the male is infuriated by it and swims towards her and then realizes that he can't destroy, that this is actually his mate and he can't destroy it, but he's developed all this aggression, and so he takes it out on some other kind of fish or a rock or something, but there's something that has to be punished in that particular ritual. So it's just there's an edge there, you know. Rituals are good, and they help us to form groups, but there's usually also an out group somewhere. Somebody who's not Buddhist, for example, might be part of our out group, or somebody who's hostile to Buddhism could be part of the out group. So that's one thing I think about. Um, Another is the nature of words. Words. And I'm very fond of the writings of Aldous Huxley. And in the appendix to a book of his called The Devils of Loudon, it's not a book I necessarily recommend for people to read. It's a very gory story of a very terrible chapter of somebody being convicted of being a sorcerer and being put to death in a terrible way. And I mean, his reason for writing the book was bigger than that. It actually had to do with the salvation of some kind of salvation of someone else. But in the appendix to the book, if you read Aldous Huxley, I really recommend always read all of his appendices. I think some of his books, The Doors of Perception, I think has 7 appendices, and they're all worth reading. Anyway, he says in this appendix to this book, the first couple of sentences, words are at once indispensable and fatal. Indispensable and fatal. Treated as working hypotheses, propositions about the world are instruments by which we are enabled progressively to understand the world. So we use words to understand the world. That's their purpose for us, is understanding the world. But then he goes on, treated as absolute truths, as dogmas to be swallowed, as idols to be worshipped, propositions about the world distort our view of reality and lead us into all kinds of inappropriate behavior. So this is kind of the delusion of words, I think is the way I would put it. The delusion of words. So just to circle back to the big pasture and to settling into the breath, to deeply settling into the breath, or deeply settling into the experience, whatever experience one is having right now. For example, if you're listening on Zoom, you have your computer screen and you have your room that you're sitting in whatever bodily posture you're in. And then you have whatever else is going on in that room. And similarly here, there are many of us here, and each of us are abiding breathing, 2 arms and 2 legs and a head. So I don't know how it is for all of you as you try to settle into the breath. As someone who's grown up always feeling I should be somewhere, some way other than I am, this is easily extended to the breath. It should also be some way other than it is. So it's very easy to get into judging it and all kinds of things. Is it too long or too short, or too deep or too shallow, or posture not right, etc., etc.? So it's hard to just leave oneself alone, to leave oneself alone. But it's vital that we make this effort to do so, because if we don't, we're not present in what we're doing. I think last year when I was here, I mentioned a quote from the Avatamsaka Sutra. I'm not going to try to find it right now, but it was something to the effect of, there is nothing in addition to reality. There is nothing in addition to reality. But we get easily confused and think that there is something in addition to reality. There's many possibilities. And of course, Suzuki Roshi did say in the expert's mind, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. So there's many possibilities, but there's different ways of thinking about that. When we get caught up in a lot of possibilities of what might happen or what things mean or what actually happened, and we also have so many words coming at us. If we plug into the internet and we listen to commentators, especially commentators who share our political leanings, and they can be instructing us as to what we should do in this moment to combat the current situation, how many calling your senators, writing to your senators, protesting in this way and protesting in that way. And I can't help thinking we should be doing something, but what should we be doing? And how should this being be doing it? And what exactly should this being be doing? That's the tricky point. I feel that if I'm not at home, then I'm not likely to be really helping the situation much. I think it's much better to be present and then see what we can do. And to acknowledge the grief, you know? Atlantic Magazine for February, a large section of the magazine is taken up with photographs and little bios of various people who were fired from the government and the wonderful work that they were doing that is no longer being done. So it's hard to read. Grief comes up. But still, with all the grief that comes up, I come back to the fact that I do not really know what is going on. I know what I read in the papers. I know what I see in the videos, but in a larger sense, I do not know what is going on. I don't believe people will write history books about it. But what is it? What is it? This question of what is it? If I think I know what's going on, I think I'm endangering people, to tell you the truth. To have a deep confidence that I know what's going on. I know what I think is going on. And I have a pile of protest signs in my trunk of my car. And I try to figure out what one's appropriate and haul them out and stand with my fellow citizens. But I also try very hard, because it's really hard, to listen to my friend who supports a very different viewpoint. So it's 8:30, so I think I should stop now and give some time to talk. And I hope, because I've sort of, you can tell my leanings, so I hope I haven't discouraged someone who might have very different leanings from speaking if they wish. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm gonna ask the first question or make the first comment because I was struck by what you just said not too long ago about if you don't feel that you're at home, you don't think you think you might, you know, not be able to help or something like that. Yeah, that what you have to offer may be off in some way. If you don't feel that you're at home, in other words, if you don't feel that really settled, like you feel at home, you feel quite settled and safe, usually at home. And I've often noticed this when I go to demonstrations and things that I don't quite feel at home because of some of the things that are chanted and I think are too harsh or too much invective, too much profanity and so forth. I feel like what does that help? That just sounds angry and I don't feel at home with that, you know. So the one place that I really felt at home in activism was several times working in the Buddhist election retreat that's sponsored by the Berkeley Zen Center. And there, when we practice that way, what we do is we practice in the morning. We practice. Like, we get up early and we sit zazen, and then we have breakfast, and we sit zazen some more, and then we might have a dharma talk. And then, and only then, after we have settled ourselves at home, and we are in our native environment of practice, then we go out on the street and walk door to door and talk to people who are going to vote. And that feels so, you know, that one activity was the one activism that I felt so right about, that because I was doing it from a place of where I feel very much at home, you know. So I think it's not to say that's the only kind of place, you know, the only way you can feel at home. I think some people can go to these demonstrations and feel quite at home no matter what happens. But anyway, I just thought I'd offer that observation.
May I just comment on his comment? No, and then we'll go to. I just wanted to, if I may. I think your way of using at home is a little bit different. I relate to it, but what I meant about being home or being settled is settled whatever anybody else is doing. That's the large pastor. So, for example, I also have problems, the same problems, and feel discomfort with a lot of the chanting, and I just don't chant. I just don't open my mouth for the chants. So I agree, if we have like a retreat or something, I could have said, why don't I sit zazen instead of, but I didn't. I said to myself, why don't I go to the Y? Because I found that exercise is also very healthy and it is grounding. I feel grounded when I exercise. Let's go on. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. I was relating to your comment about family members, those are the people closest to us. My family has a Zoom call once a month with cousins, and some of my cousins are MAGA supporters. And we try to not bring things up like that in these family conversations. We talk about family and how people are. And I've always been a bit uncomfortable with that, but, you know, peace in the family is first. But this last Sunday, it did come up. And one of my cousins, you know, said, well, those people deserve it. They're here illegally. And no one responded, which was good. But afterwards, I was having an aside conversation with one of my cousins about, you know, what was going on. Why does Tim feel that way? You know, we all grew up in the same environment, and that was not the way we grew up. And as he and his sister and I, or his sister and I, were talking, why? And we were going back about how he actually lost his job at one point, and that was a very traumatizing event for him. And he felt that he was pushed out and unfairly, and that kind of resentment and anger has festered in him. And all of a sudden it was like, so this is expressing itself, it seems, in this resentment towards immigrants. And that was helpful for me and my to understand more about having more compassion for why he is expressing this opinion. It's coming out of his own trauma in his life. And that I find is very helpful. I can only think what trauma that ICE officer who shot Jeffrey Pettit is experiencing now. Human beings can't commit that kind of violence without having it affect them. And so that approach has really helped me in feeling a connection with people who disagree with me and feeling compassion for what they're going through too. So
thank you for the comment.
Yeah, Kathy, thank you very much for your talk. What I got out of your talk, I think you were pointing at a very important thing about human knowledge and the difference between knowledge and opinion. I've read through the Nikayas, and what comes up over and over again is that, you know, to really know something, you have to know it of yourself, you know, direct by direct experience. And I'm very concerned these days because I believe that the media that we're constantly bombarded with creates a false reality in our minds because, you know, I've told my children since they were little, because all this stuff is on the TV, that most of what they see has very little to do with their actual life, you know, and we all have our opinions. We hang on to them very tightly because we think they're who we are, and I don't believe that's the case. You know, we are human beings, and I come in contact with all kinds of people, and Neil Leahy gave a talk a number of years ago that really got to me. He was talking about freedom, and I've come to the conclusion that the real freedom is the freedom to refrain.
Freedom from?
To refrain. I can refrain from action. I can refrain from judgment.
Yeah.
And you know, we all have our own opinions. Everybody's entitled to one, but I don't feel the need to share mine necessarily unless asked. And my teacher said something during a talk one time that I thought was very interesting, because I asked the question, well, you know, if we're supposed to save all beings, we'll save them from what? And she said, from ourselves. So I think it's a very nice way to keep the peace.
I'll remember that.
I really, really resonated with a lot of what you said. I feel like I really don't know what's going on, but there's things that I think, and I know what I think, and I know what I felt at home with. And I felt at home with one thing that my philosophy professor said to us once. Brooke Morris said, none of us owns any of these ideas. They're not ours. We just get to engage with them. And it was so liberating to then be able to just get into a concept and tear it up and not tear each other up. It just was so liberating, and it felt so good to be able to like really get into an issue with someone but not take it personally. That was really freeing for me. Also, my mother and father, one being a Jew, one being a Mormon, coming together, leaving their respective religions behind for each other, and growing up seeing that, what I latched onto with that was, I don't know if what they did was right, but it felt really good. It felt like home for me. When I see people take relationships above their pedagogy or their beliefs or their dogmas, they put their relationships above those things. To me, that always feels like at home for me. So anytime my measure is when I see an issue or a debate or something on the news start to make people question their relationships with people, that's where I feel like I'm leaving my home. You know, when I have a friend tell me, oh, did you hear so-and-so's a Trumper? And he's talking about somebody who's been a brother to me for 20 years. And I'm thinking, so what? He's my brother. That's what really matters. On Saturday, I read this poem by Walt Whitman, and Leaves of Grass, and I forget the title of it. It was something that, like, I think it was called The Underpinnings of Metaphysics. And the whole point of the poem was that underneath all of the philosophies, Plato, Socrates, everything, it's how I feel about my brother, he said, how I feel about my friend. That's the most foundational thing of all of it. And to me, that's it, you know? So when I have a moment when I really connect with my father-in-law, who is a Trumper, and I'm not a Trumper, you know, those are our two categories. But we really just find just connection. And we put that aside. To me, I feel like I'm closer to what's really going on. That I feel I'm more at home. So I feel what you're saying about that. So when people start to demonize each other, that's all this polarization is. That's choosing these issues above our relationships, you know. I feel like we got really that whole razor's edge thing you talked about of equanimity versus the other piece of like just not caring. That's hard because I do want to care about what's going on out there, but like you, I'm at the tail end of this news feed, and I don't know what all really happened that led up to that message that came to me through my phone. You know, so am I going to jump on that and attack somebody because of that? I'm going to hedge my bet on that one, you know.
I appreciate your deep commitment to relationships and to not abandoning people easily. When I used the word home, I'm not sure it was quite the right word because I don't know if it's in this essay or another essay where Suzuki Roshi says, if the boss is at home or if the boss is awake, you know, then everything is in control in the larger sense. Do you know what I'm talking about where he talks about the boss? I don't think it's this one. I'm not going to leaf through to try to find it. What he's talking about here, I think, is something that goes deeper than this, deeper than it it goes to, it allows, it facilitates intimacy, which is, I think, what you're talking about, maintaining intimacy with people that you've known for a long time. It supports that and allows for that. And I think at the same time, it could also, in some cases, support schism when that seems like the appropriate thing. So, and that schism doesn't have to be hatred of the other person. Hopefully, it's not that. But it can still be a parting of ways, and that can happen. I don't think we can rule that out, that happens at times. However, having the mind that allows, that's spacious enough to, what does he say? He says, the true purpose is to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. So this goes beyond any ideas that we have. It goes beyond any ideas that we have. It's I can't really express it better than that. But it's, in some sense, the heart of Zen. It's a very radical. It's a very radical way of being in the world that is worth aspiring to and aiming at. And having said that, I appreciate commitment to relationships and commitment to hearing people out and trying to understand what they're saying and accept them, even if sometimes the acceptance means we accept them, but not in relationship to us physically for some time at least. That can happen. Yeah. Another question.
Thank you, Kathy. I guess my question is the passage you just read about seeing things as they are and having them go as they go, that's my vague understanding of that. Is that what we're trying to do through, what you're trying to do through protests? I mean, is that what we're collectively being called to do through protesting? Or this is like a different, two different concepts, or what's the relationship between those things?
The seeing things as they are, and observing things as they are, and letting things go as they go, is sometimes going to a protest. It's the mind that one holds when one does such an action, when we do whatever we do. That's what it is. It's the mind. Even if people are around us and are saying things that we don't agree with, you know, and sometimes I don't sometimes if there's one protester who dominates the situation, and they're dominating the situation in a way that I really think is, you know, I might speak to them and say, you know, I don't think this is really so good, what you're doing here. But people can be very stubborn, and that's what they want to do, so I just don't go to that protest until something more happens, and then I feel drawn to go there, and then I'm like, am I going to go? Am I not going to go? And I went to the Y instead. Not that the Y is, you know, I grounded myself in that exercise, you know, exercising a little bit, and went about my life for that time in a different way. I wasn't turning away from the issue of border agents killing a VA nurse. Or border patrol agents dragging people from their cars and taking 2-year-olds or 5-year-olds. I'm not turning away from that. But I'm asking Karen's question, what can I do? What is helpful? And so if there are millions of people out in the street, I'm going to be out there with them. You know? If a riot is starting, if it looks like a situation that's leaning toward a riot, or if it looks like a situation where this kind of polarization arising that I think is really ugly, I don't want to be part of it. So, but within all of that, I want to dedicate myself to the true purpose, to see things as they are, to observe things as they are, and to let everything go as it goes. Dedication is not the same thing as realizing. It's not like I've realized it, but I sometimes describe it as aiming at the fabric of your life. Aim exactly at the fabric of your life.
I guess I'll go. Kathy, is it?
Yeah. Kathy.
Thank you for coming, by the way. It's very
You're welcome.
Good. There were two things in your talk that really I connect together in an unusual way. I think we were talking about what do we do, or I don't have the answers, or something like that. And then when there was that story about the kid and his father, and the father says, my favorite animal is human. It's like, that's not an animal. Yes, it is an animal. But as animals, because I'm going to disagree with the kid, we may not always consciously have the answer, but I think unconsciously, and I don't know if this is a Buddhist teaching, but it's something I go with. Usually our gut does have the answer. Our intuition usually does. If you've never encountered a situation before, or something feels slightly different than before, and you don't know consciously what to do, usually unconsciously, at least I find, and I probably think everyone does, we all kind of unconsciously know what to do. Like in that protest, things are getting a little heated, maybe I want to step aside. Following your gut and going to the YMCA, or me, I may just be like, yeah, I don't feel like going to that protest at all. I'm not a Trumper, by the way, so I'm going to get that away. But I think that might be a possible answer, is if we don't have the answer, usually we do deep within us in the form of our intuition, in the form of our gut instinct. And I think that's because we're animals, we were born with that. And sometimes that's the best we have. Sometimes that's the thing that can just see and react instantly to the world the way it is, because our unconscious doesn't go through conception after conception after conception. It just reacts. And sometimes that is often the best answer. Not always. Sometimes our gut gets it wrong. But that's how I kind of connect those two in your talk, and kind of a different way of looking at it for me. But I just think when in doubt, your gut is probably the best approach you can in under times of extreme uncertainty as the times we live in. Thank you. That's just my thought.
I want to recommend a book to everyone. It's called Being Wrong. Being Wrong. And it's Catherine Schulz is the author. And it's a very good book. And basically her point is we cannot, Well, she has many points, but one of the points is we cannot avoid being wrong. Because we're human animals, we are wrong. We're wrong a million times a day in many, many different ways, and it's often this is deeply embarrassing to us, and she goes through many situations where people have been embarrassed by their various wrong, but it's really in our genes. We can't help it. So there are certain kinds of situations where, of course, an animal kind of very quick response accomplishes something. As a general principle, not always so. Not always so. I guess that's what I would say about it. Yeah. Anybody else?
Your comment makes me reflect how I feel sometimes when we're watching the news and somebody will say, I can't believe this happened in this community. And I'll find myself saying, why not? Why not? And it's easy for me to say because I'm not there. But it happened to me recently where I was meeting with someone that I study with. Alcoholism, and she said, you know, my daughter is a Trumper, and I just can't believe after everything that I'm, and I said, well, why not? You know, these are challenges, and these are ways to learn, and it's easy for me to point the finger, but a lot of times I really have to. It just is that way.